Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. For the record, this is May 24th, 2017. We've got a full agenda today, and we're going to start by moving one of the bills down to rules because we won't have time to work it.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
We have to open on that.
Oh, excuse me. I have to open a work session on House Bill 3337A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3337A without recommendation and request referral to the Committee on Rules.
Senator Thompson has moved House Bill 3337A without recommendation to the
Senate Committee.
To the Senate
Senate Committee on Rules.
To the Senate Committee on Rules. That's right. Said that right. Discussion on a motion. Any opposition to the motion? There is none. It's done. We're closed on that. And where do we want to start? And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2975. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me just flip to that particular file. So, Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2975A allows the court to award attorney fees to a prevailing retail customer who brings action against a vehicle dealer with a claim of fraud, fraudulent representation, or violations relating to vehicle registration, vehicle permits, transfers, or alterations of vehicles, or regulation of vehicle dealers. It allows the court to award damages of $500 for violations of vehicle code relating to vehicle registrations, vehicle permits, transfer, alteration of vehicles, or regulation of vehicle dealers. This measure comes to us with no fiscal or revenue impact. There's no amendment. It had a House vote of 36 to 20, and I believe our Representative Malmstrom is here to speak.
Representative Malmstrom.
Right there, front row.
There you are. Welcome, Representative. I think it's your first time in front of our committee.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sherry Malmstrom, and I represent House District 27, which is in Beaverton and Southeast Portland. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2975A, which would strengthen consumer protections from bad actors. Oregon consumers are buying cars without receiving their titles from the dealer. These are consumers who have met all their obligations under the contract, but some dealers still fail to deliver the title either to the consumer or to the consumer's lender. The title is often delayed from anywhere to 6 to 9 months, but some consumers never receive their title or may take years. The House Business and Labor Committee heard testimony from one consumer who paid cash for her car in May of 2015 and still had not received her title as of March 13th on the day of the public hearing. When consumers do not receive their title on time, they can't register their car and therefore they can't legally drive it. All the while, the consumer will still have to continue to make the payments on their cars that they have purchased. The bill, as amended, would allow courts to award attorney fees to prevailing retail customers who bring actions against a vehicle dealer with a claim of fraud, fraudulent representation, or violations relating to a vehicle registration, vehicle permits, transfer, or alteration of vehicles, or regulation of vehicle dealers. It would allow courts to award damages of $500 for violations of vehicle code related to vehicle registrations, vehicle permits, transfer, or alteration of vehicles, or regulation of vehicle dealers. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, this is a good bill intended to provide consumers with a tool to hold bad actors accountable. We know that the ability to pay attorney's fees is often the largest single barrier for justice. I urge your support of HB 2975A, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? No questions?
Great.
Wow, that was easy, wasn't it?
Good. I can get off the healthcare committee on time.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. I'm going to temporarily recess on this one and open a public hearing on House Bill 2111.
All right, Mr. Chair. Real quickly, House Bill 2111 prohibits the inclusion of any declaration or bylaws on a planning committee that allow or prevent an owner from installing or using solar panels. This measure has no fiscal or revenue impact. There's no amendment, Mr. Chair. It came to us with a House vote of 56 to 3, and there's Representative Greenleaf right there.
Representative. Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, that has a lot of roofs in it on which a solar panel could be placed. The bill is pretty straightforward. It simply prohibits a homeowners association from prohibiting blanketly solar panels and allows, it keeps the association's ability to regulate size, placement, and aesthetics of the solar panel, but it just would be, requires them to say, no, you can't under any circumstances have a solar panel. And that's all there is to it.
Just that. Okay. Questions? I see none, Representative. Thank you.
Go back to work. Thank you all.
Go back to work. Okay. I've got this open. I don't have anybody signed up on this one. Does anybody else want to discuss House Bill 2111A? I guess we'll reset. We will close the public hearing on that, and we will reopen on House Bill 2975A. I have a long list here. Let's see, starting out with Ellen Hansen and Young Walsh. I'm not going to say your name right. I didn't the last time either, did I? I apologize for that.
It's a tough one. It's not the first time it's happened.
Walgin Kim?
Walgin Kim.
I got it right.
Yeah.
Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Adam Hansen, and I'm here with my partner-in-law, Young Walgin Kim. We are consumer representatives. We represent consumers in transactions, specifically when they have issues with a vehicle purchase. That's what we do, and we are here to express our support for 2975A. As you heard from Representative Malmstrom, Oregonians are buying vehicles and from time to time not getting their title. Some people might think, well, how in the world does this happen? Well, there are a couple of scenarios that are common that we see with the phone calls we get. One of the first is easy to understand. The dealer goes out of business. They go out of business. They haven't delivered title yet. The purchaser has to figure out, well, how in the heck am I going to get title? There are some processes and procedures, but frequently people are left without a final remedy. Another scenario that happens is dealers will purchase this vehicle on credit, something they're allowed to do, and they'll sell it before they've cleared the title. Under those specific rules, if they sell a vehicle on credit, they're supposed to take the proceeds and then clear title, deliver it, and they have, the rules vary, but it's about 30 days that they're supposed to deliver that title. And from time to time, that doesn't occur. For whatever reason, the dealer decides to use funds for other purposes. Don't really know. All I know is on my end, I hear from people who don't have their title. Now, this is already against the law. There was testimony submitted by the DMV, and I believe they're going to be testifying later on this. There are rules in place. We have a visual that go ahead and get it up here. Make the technology work.
There you go.
There you go. All right. So we have a... this is a graph of DMV sanctions. This was taken from the DMV's quarterly publication that they put out to the public. It looks back to spring of 2011, as you can see there. And the blue bars represent the number of total violations, the number of total sanctions issued by the department. And then the red bar is every sanction that has something to do with a title issue. And as you can see, if you work through year to year, the totals at the bottom, you can see that roughly half of the violations that occur that boil down to a sanction are related to some sort of title issue. And we end up with an average of about one sanction per day. It's actually more than that. It's about 400 a year is what it works out to. So this is a problem that's occurring. And looking year to year, it continues to occur. Even though we have rules in place, it doesn't appear to have the proper deterring effect as it continues to happen. Now, right now, the status quo is that the buyer, if they have this issue, they have to pay for their own attorney. They can go to these agencies and they can get some assistance, but ultimately, as we're going to hear, they're going to have to hire an attorney. And this is right after they've just made a down payment, committed to serious monthly payments, or sometimes paid cash outright. Typically, from the people we speak with, there isn't room left in the budget to do anything else. They already bought the car. They were supposed to get the title. They didn't hold in reserve some extra money so they could get what they already paid for. And what this bill does is it allows these purchasers to collect attorney fees from the dealer or its bond so that they can afford to hire the help they need to resolve this problem. That's what I have to share with you. I'll allow my partner to testify now.
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, my name is Young Walgen Kim. I'm a private attorney here in Salem. I just want to testify that this is a real problem. I mean, we hear, just last week, we received four phone calls from four different individuals complaining about this same problem. That was just last week. And this problem doesn't just affect consumers. It affects businesses, too, a lot of small businesses. More businesses buy cars than sell them. And there are small businesses like general contractors, landscapers, painters, and we've heard from them who haven't received their title, and that has a huge impact in their business. This is a problem that affects real people, but the solution in 29758 is very simple. And you're going to hear from a representative of car dealers, and they'll come here and probably propose different solutions and things like that. But I want you to ask, are these other solutions getting the titles for the victims? For example, there's SB 974 solves this problem. Well, actually, it doesn't. It's a good bill. It helps consumers. What it does is it increases the bond limit. But what it does, it doesn't deliver the title for the consumer. So even with 974, the consumer still has to pay out of pocket for their own attorney and to get their title. You're going to hear from some actual victims of this practice, and you hear that they've contacted the DMV, the DOJ, even the police, and you know they were helpful in some ways, but they ultimately couldn't get them the title because it's not these agencies' job. They were all told to hire an attorney. HB 2975A, it's about these victims.
Could you repeat what you just said? I didn't catch it off. Who was told to hire an attorney?
So these victims of this practice, the actual consumers who are going to testify later.
Told by whom?
By the DOJ or the DMV. They also went to the Salem police, and they were told, okay, we can't help you with this problem. You need to hire your own attorney. And so it's really about these victims. It's about getting the titles for them. And it's the dealer, really, that broke the law. This is actually a violation of the law, and the dealer, since the dealer is the one who broke the law, it should be on the dealer to pay for that solution.
So one of the counters to that I think we'll hear is that, well, they already have a bond and we've just moved to increase it. Why doesn't the bond cover the cost of getting the title back?
That's a very good question, Chair Beyer. So there is already a bond, and yes, it is being increased with 974. But the problem with the language in the bond right now is it doesn't provide for attorney fees for the consumers. So there's a bond now, and when the consumers call us, we say, okay, well, it's going to be such and such amount, probably around $1,000 to get your title for you, and they don't have the money. They're not. They can't get to work. Sometimes they spent the money on their.
So you're saying the bond is not accessible by the consumer to pay for the attorney's fees if that's the necessity to get it?
That is correct, Chair Beyer, and HB 2975A. Allows that accessibility, and it works very well in conjunction with 974 because that increases the bond. If there are more claims to the bond because of 2975, then SB 974 will allow for that because it increased that limit.
Senator?
I just have, why would somebody walk out of, is this mainly new cars or used cars?
It only happens with used cars, Senator.
Why would somebody walk out of a used car dealership after giving them money without a title? Why would you do that?
Senator Thompson, that's a very good question. Generally, when people are buying a used car from a car dealer, that car dealer does not hold the title because they've bought these cars on credit. So they haven't paid off the liens on these cars. And they're allowed to do this. And they can sell this car without having the title. But what they're supposed to do under the DMV rules is to, when they get paid from either the customer or the lender, they're supposed to take this money and pay off the lien so that the previous lien holder can release the title and the dealer can deliver that title. They have about 30 days to do this. It's when they violated this rule that's already law, then the consumer should have a right of action to seek their title through legal action.
Chair Byer, Senator Thompson, to expand on that just slightly. Frequently in these transactions, customers pay the dealer to do the DMV title transfer work for them, so they're not expecting to walk out with the title in hand. You know, if you've ever been involved in a private party transaction, you probably just had a signed title that someone hands to you. Yeah. When they go to the dealership, they say, you know, you've got all these, you know, these title transfer fees and things like that. We'll take care of that for you. We're going to add it into the cost of your financing or add it into your bottom line. So they charge them, you know, a title transfer fee that they then pay to the DMV. And they have, most dealers, even small dealers, will have a title clerk, and that's their job, is they deal with transferring titles for all of these transactions. So they don't create an expectation of title being delivered, even though we might think that's how it goes, because they build it into the transaction that they're going to get a clean title with your name on it mailed to you, or in the case of financing, mailed to your lien holder. And that's, you don't have to deal with that as part of the service they offer.
Anything else?
No.
Other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, let's see. Francine Beck and Fred Young, it looks like, and, well, yeah, no, we'll leave it there.
Thank you for having me. My name's Francine Beck, and I'm from Vida, Oregon. My husband, Rich, died recently. Rich didn't have a life insurance policy. So knowing I'd be several months until I received death benefits or Social Security, I lived on what was in the bank and credit cards. After several months, my benefits arrived. They came in a lump sum. And after cremating Richard, I had some money left and thought the best use of it would be to purchase a couple vehicles that were reliable for my sons. I paid cash for both vehicles at the same dealership, and I also bought warranties and for both cars and obtained insurance. Time passed. No title came in the mail for either car. I called the dealer with no response, left many messages. I then received a letter from the warranty company indicating that my warranties were not good due to the lack of payment from the dealer. I contacted the dealer again. I did get a hold of him. I let him know about the warranties, and he asked me to fax him the letter so he could take care of things. A week went by. I contacted the warranty company again. They still had not received the money from the dealer. I continued calling the dealer and couldn't even leave a message. His mailbox was full. With a little time left on the temporary tags, I contacted DMV to see about the titles and to see if I could get more time on the tags. She said I could get a temporary trip permit for $30 for 21 days for each car, and that I could only get two in a 12-month period, meaning I could pay another $120 to drive the cars for 41 days. She also gave me some bad news on both cars and suggested I talk to DMV Investigations. DMV Investigations gave me more bad news on both cars, doubting that I could get valid titles on either car, and said she could possibly get me tags with 90 days extensions as a courtesy, and that I may want to use this time to contact an attorney in order to be able to get my titles. I contacted three attorneys, asking if they would work on a contingency basis, being a new widow and having a limited income. I knew I could not pay attorney fees myself. I was referred to Attorney Walgenkim, told him my story, and he agreed to represent me. I gave that dealer everything that I had. I felt like I was going to end up with nothing, two cars that would never be legal, that didn't have titles, and that no one could drive. This was the biggest decision I made without my partner. I felt like I let everyone down and that I'd be able, would never be able to recover financially. Every piece of correspondence from DMV indicates that they will prosecute dealers for dishonest practices, but that does not include any type of recovery to their victims. If it wasn't for Walgen, Kim, and Hansen, I would never have been able to recover from this dishonest dealer. I'm a widow, and I urge you to pass this bill. Thank you.
So, ma'am, I assume you finally got a title to the two vehicles?
I have gotten one.
Still have the not the other?
Still not the other one.
Is the dealer still in business?
No.
And so Senator Thompson's question, why did you take the cars without a title, accept them without
a
title?
Okay. When I was 20 years old, I was a title clerk.
Okay.
At a pretty big dealership. Nobody walked out of there with a title. Nobody. The money is owed. They do a lot of things with that money. And until the paperwork is through, and then they charge you on top of it $75 a piece to handle your paperwork for you. But that is not the way it works, especially in small dealerships. They do not give you your title when you leave. Just like you don't have your plates or your tags, you go with a temporary sticker on your car and an agreement. And they just don't stick with the agreement. And on top of it, when I testified before, there was indication that DMV takes all of this. Well, if I would have known or thought about it, I would have brought the letters that I've gotten from DMV, and in every DMV letter it says, get an attorney. DMV does not handle anything that has to do with money and getting it back to the victims of foul play.
Did you attempt to get any money back through their bond?
Yes, we did. I did with the help of Mr. Walgenkamp.
And were you able to get enough to cover your attorney's fee?
Yes.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank
sir. Yes, my name is Fred Young. How are you doing, guys? And mine's kind of a similar story, except for it's an RV that we purchased.
Could you move the mic over a little bit?
Sure.
There you go.
We purchased a RV, a travel trailer through Northwest RV. And when we purchased it, I noticed that the tags were up in, we purchased it in September 13th. The tags were up at the end of October. So with that, I talked to them about it. They said they would add that on to the transfer of the title and stuff, and we'd get our tags. Month went by, didn't hear from them. We had already planned on taking a trip. So she said, well, you know, it takes a little while to get, you know, get them, and that she would be working on it. And she said to go to DMV and just buy a trip permit. So I tried to do that without the title or, you know, anything. They said that that they should be doing that for us. I called them back, and they were already out of business. This was like 3 days later. So in the meantime, we were stuck, you know, without. So first thing I did was call the bank or the credit union, actually, that we did business with to find out if they had been sent the title. This was like a month and a half. Nope. All they had was a copy. So they didn't have the title, so they just told us to go to, she referred us to DMV to do an investigation on it. So we went there, same thing. They said they would do an investigation. They said that, you know, we needed to hire an attorney. Went to the sheriff's office, same thing. It was a legal matter. They couldn't touch it. Go seek an attorney. With the money that we put out, we're on a low income, and we didn't have the money to even seek an attorney. So we talked to Young, and I can't pronounce his last name either. So he did us a favor and did a pro bono on it, and so therefore we didn't have to come up with the money. And 3 weeks later, we had our title. And we sent, you know, the title actually went with DMV. We went down and they sent that off to the credit union, which probably should have helped us in the meantime. They didn't. DMV didn't help. But we did finally get our tags through him and only because of him.
Did you, I guess in your case, you didn't have the thought of, did anybody ever suggest that you contact the Attorney General's office, consumer?
No. No, it was pretty much just, you know, obtain an attorney. That's what pretty much everybody was saying. We tried through all the steps that that people even offered or sent us to, and it was pretty much obtain an attorney.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome.
Let's see here. Arnold and Ruth Ann Koch?
Cook.
Welcome.
July 12th of last year, we purchased a...
I need to have you put your name on the record, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Ruth Ann Cook, K-O-C-H.
And I'm Arnold Cook, her husband.
Okay. Go ahead.
On July 12th of last year, we purchased a 2004 Monaco coach from Northwest RV Sales in Salem. 3 months later, we went to the Oregon DMV and completed a request for investigation stating that Northwest RV Sales had closed their business and we had not received the title for our coach and had been contacted by the previous owner that he still held the title. This caused us great concern and anxiety about the status of our ownership. The clerk at the DMV advised that we hire an attorney, which we did at our own expense. As the months passed, the license tags were due to expire, and since we could not renew the license without a title, we were very worried, since unlicensed RVs are not allowed in most RV parks, which would mean we would have no place to live since the coach is our home.
Okay, baby.
Seven months from the date of the purchase of our coach, after many telephone calls and letters from our attorney, we finally received our title, which could now be transferred into our name and then license tags renewed. Had we not been able to hire an attorney, we probably would still be trying to get the title that was rightfully ours. We ask you to support this bill to help other Oregonians who are financially unable to hire an attorney to obtain their titles in a timely manner. Thank you.
Oh, questions, Senator Riley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, did I understand you to say that you contacted the previous owner who held the title? Is that correct?
Can I answer it? She doesn't want me to talk, so I'll get wound up.
Okay. I completely understand, sir.
And I am wound up. He called me after he had gone down to the dealership, and they said, well, we don't haven't sold your coach. He wanted the money or his coach.
Sure.
Well, that was in probably October. We'd owned it since July, so they lied to him. So he came back, I think about a week later, right? Mm. And he said, I want my coach or my money. And he got very upset, and they called the police and had him removed. He called us and said, I have the title, so why don't you go ahead and bring the coach over to my house, and you can stay in the he has a hangar, I guess, I don't know. But he's got the title. So if he decides to lock us out or whatever, he's got the title. We're making payments, have made payments. We're out. Tough luck. So I don't know the man, didn't know anything about the man. So we took off. That was our recommendation, that we just kind of disappear for a while. So we went to Arizona, New Mexico, and at great expense to stay away from this guy so he wouldn't steal back his coach. He had the title. Well, he didn't have the title. He lied. And long story short, he went to DMV and said the whole deal fell through. So DMV hands him the title. After we had already been with our lawyers doing what they said to do, and we had gone to DMV and they didn't give us the title, but they handed it over to him. So that's kind of where we're at. So.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, Bill Perry and Daryl Fuller.
Seems like this ought to be the Judiciary Committee.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Oregon Vehicle Dealers Association here today in opposition to House Bill 2975. First, want to acknowledge that there are consumers that get harmed by dealers that are bad actors. There's no question about that at all. And those of us that are involved in the auto dealer industry who have members who do things the right way and who follow the rules are just as frustrated by the people who break the rules and just as frustrated by the people who rip people off because it makes all of us look bad. In addition to making all of us look bad, when things like bonds are increased, when attorney's fees are added, when penalties are added, insurance that we have to pay to cover these things goes up for all of the good dealers in order to pay for the bad actors. And that's where we get a sense of frustration. We, as the largest association of vehicle dealers in Oregon, come to the legislature with ideas like Senate Bill 974, trying to find ways to build additional access for consumers to get recovery under these circumstances. And if you're one of the victims, statistics don't matter, but just let me give you an idea of the scope of what we're talking about. Last year in Oregon, and DMV may have more accurate numbers than I do, but last year in Oregon, I believe we estimated that car dealers sold somewhere between 450 and 500,000 cars. To Oregon residents or people from outside the state of Oregon. So approximately 500,000 vehicles were sold through vehicle dealers. DMV had about 600 complaints that people didn't get their titles. So if you want to calculate...
One more time.
I'm sorry?
What was the last number you said?
I believe there were 661 complaints. Or
didn't get their titles?
That people who filed complaints that they didn't get their titles. So if you multiply that out, I think you're somewhere close to a fraction of a percent or a percent of the people that aren't getting their titles in time. In a lot of cases, and in fact I would suggest that in most cases, that is because the dealer who has taken a vehicle in on trade, all right, and the person that they've taken the vehicle in on trade from has a loan out on that vehicle. So the dealer takes that vehicle in. The first thing they do, all the good dealers, the first thing they do is cut a check to pay off that lien holder. All right, and they send that check to wherever the checks go for the lien holder. Now the financial institution has to release the title to the dealer. Well, financial institutions generally warehouse all the titles from all of the states in one place. So you may send a payoff to a location in Austin, Texas, and when they get that check, then they notify their warehouse in New York that go look up the deal in Oregon and to release that title. And by the time the dealer gets that title back, it can be 30, 45, 60 days before the dealer even gets that title, even if they've sent off the payment immediately. So that's not the dealer's fault that there's a delay. And in some cases, I'm not even saying it's the financial institution's problem, because what we have is a paper title. We can't do electronic payoff. We can do electronic payoff, but we have to have that physical title. And if the financial institution or anybody in this process loses that title, you have to get a new title from DMV before you can transfer it. So sometimes there are just delays in the process that have absolutely nothing to do with anybody doing anything crooked or doing anything wrong. It is just the paperwork process that we go in. I think you'll hear from DMV that of the 600 and some odd complaints they got last year, they were able to resolve about 80 to 85% of them without needing a lawyer. In most cases, when a consumer isn't getting what they need, if you go to DMV and DMV does an investigation and a dealer has done something wrong or the dealer's taking too long, DMV giving the dealer a call and saying, you need to get this taken care of, gets the problem taken care of. So we're talking about a very, very small number of people that end up in the unfortunate circumstances that the people that testified before us did. One of the concerns that we have, if you were to pass 2975 and allow attorney's fees to come out of the bond, is, as people have already testified, the bond at $50,000, if Senate Bill 974 goes into effect, that bond, if a dealership fails, disappears real quickly because there are a lot of complaints and only $50,000 available to consumers. Well, if you start allowing consumers to take attorney's fees outside of that bond instead of just recovery, the bond's going to disappear a lot faster, and fewer consumers who apply for recovery out of the bond are going to get any kind of recovery at all. I don't want to take too long, so I apologize. We have a lot of concerns about the way the bill is drafted. We have a lot of concerns about the implications of the bill. We'd be happy to work with the proponents on trying to find solutions to these problems in a collaborative fashion, but the solution that they have found isn't one that we can accept. We're particularly concerned in the language of the bill. On page 2, line 20, it says $500 for violations, and I'm getting different people saying different things because there can be multiple violations of the vehicle code in one court case. So does this mean that a judge is going to say, okay, well, you alleged four different violations of the vehicle code, so therefore it's going to be a $2,000 penalty for one transaction in out of the bond in addition to whatever the recovery is? I believe, and I don't know, but I believe it was the intention of the proponents of the bill to say that it would be $500 if they prevail. But the language of the bill seems to suggest to me that somebody could interpret that to say that it could be 500 times how many other violations that they allege. So we the bill has problems from our perspective, and I can go on further, but I won't, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Do you want to talk about the committee?
Bill?
Thank you. For the record, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Bill Perry at the Oregon Auto Dealers Association, and basically for a lot of the same concerns that Mr. Fuller talked about. The issue is that most of these problems are solved today, and I agree that we hear those examples, and it's frustrating. But when we talk about the title transfer process, and I think one of you kind of touched on it earlier, is, you know, I'm signing the document as a dealer that I'm going to transfer that title, and then the consumer sign of it. There's a contract. Whether or not, you know, I mean, that is a contract. And they could go to DOJ today, and I don't know why they haven't, that it's a breach of contract. And there are different provisions in there for solutions to that. For what we're talking about is dealers, most of these cases where they're not getting fees through the bonds, or it's when somebody's going out of business and getting attorney's fees from those certain situations is going to be difficult anyway. And so when we're talking about the 85% of the ones that are being solved today, you have a potential for attorney's fees in those, and that's where the expense comes in, is where it's being solved today, the attorneys can now get involved and then potentially increase the cost of even some of the solutions. And so I think that under the breach of contract and other things through DOJs, there should be situations for these guys to rectify it under the current system today, and even the ones that aren't being cured are generally people are out of business, and I'm not sure that, you know, attorney's fees getting from those people is going to be easy to do. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Question, Senator.
Thank you. Are we going to hear from DOJ at all?
I don't know if DOJ's here. DMV's here. I think Amy's here. Yeah.
Well, he just referenced DOJ, and I wanted to hear what they have to say about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think they're here. Normally, DOJ, if you file a consumer complaint, it depends. I shouldn't say that.
Right.
Usually money that comes from that goes to DOJ when you recover and things goes to DOJ. It doesn't go to the consumer. Mm-hmm. Any others? Well, gentlemen, I have to admit, I'm bothered by the situation, four situations we've heard. Clearly, they were told by the state agencies, DOJ, I heard one of them say, and DMV in all cases, that there's nothing they could do, that they needed to get an attorney. So it would seem, at least at that level, that it would make sense, if the state is telling them to get an attorney, that they ought to be able to recover those costs, reasonable attorney fees. It suggests to me that maybe one of the things that your fear is that rather than people trying to work it out through DMV, that they're just going to go to the attorneys, and the standard claim we're hearing these is, you know, it just becomes a new practice of law that people recruit people rather than directing the other place. So I guess my question would be, how would you react to the idea that says you can only get attorney's fees after you've exhausted DMV? And if you're that remedy.
Mr. Chair, anything that would sort of limit the expansion of unnecessary, using attorneys unnecessarily, and I say that with all due respect to the attorneys that are here, would certainly be helpful, whether it's require them to go through a process prior to retaining an attorney, whether it's acknowledging that perhaps if it's a small dealer that doesn't have a lot of money either, that perhaps rather than only the plaintiff can receive attorney's fees, perhaps both sides should be able to, whoever wins the case. So if you're going to sue a small car dealer and allege a violation and it turns out you were wrong and the dealer wasn't, then we believe it ought to be a loser pay situation instead of only the plaintiff who sues ought to be able to get recovery.
That idea seems to be pretty much stacked against one side, a large business against an individual who's fairly unsophisticated, which is the case with most car buyers.
Well, in that case, Mr. Chair, if I might, you could limit attorney's fees on either side and say, in these circumstances, either side could recover up to X amount, and that would limit the large dealer from putting a consumer in a position where they wouldn't be able to afford if they lost the case. Say, we wouldn't allow, the judge could award attorney's fees not to exceed $2,500.
Darrell, I'm responding back to your first statement that it's a small number of bad dealers who cause this problem. If that's what we're looking at, I would think that most of the dealers wouldn't have a concern unless your fear is that every dealer where you get hung up with a financial institution, you can't get the clear title, would create a problem. Is that your fear?
Well, Mr. Chair, I have two fears, I guess, in that regard, if you'll permit me. The one is the notion that you're required to provide a clear title within 30 days. On that 31st day, you violated a rule in the vehicle code. Now, you may be waiting to get that title from a financial institution. You may have written that check, but you are in violation of the code. The code allows you to send a letter out saying, I still haven't got your title yet. But as I read this bill, an attorney could file a lawsuit. It's 31 days after the person has paid off or has purchased the vehicle. They don't have their title. So now you have a court case because they're on the 31st day. Now, in order to resolve that, the attorney is going to have an incentive to take that all the way to a judgment because that's the only way they're going to get attorney's fees, or they're going to want to negotiate attorney's fees. So now the dealer is paying for attorney's fees on a court case simply because he's waiting for the title to arrive from a financial institution and he's done everything right. The other side of that is that every one of the dealers that does everything right has a general liability insurance that they're generally going to go to in the case of a lawsuit, and it's going to be the insurance companies that are generally going to make that payout and that are going to determine when to cut the deal, as we see in a lot of business cases where it's less expensive to cut a deal than it is to go all the way through the court case. So if you expose all dealers in Oregon to unlimited attorney's fees plus a $500 penalty or perhaps multiple $500 penalties, then the general liability insurance for all dealerships is going to go up because the exposure now has gone up for the insurance companies because they now have the potential of having to pay out these penalties and the attorney's fees on any lawsuit.
Don't you think most responsible dealers, though, would be dealing with their customers and explaining, we haven't got the title yet or it's not cleared?
Mr. Chair,
working
that
out so you wouldn't get a lawsuit.
Mr. Chair, that'd be correct, but their general liability insurance is going to be based on the potential liability, not on the.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying, don't you? I think most people would be reasonable if the dealer was dealing in good faith with them and say, we've got this problem.
Mr. Chair,
I don't think you have a lawsuit.
And I would agree with that. It's the circumstances of the people that testified ahead of me that are gut-wrenching circumstances are sad and rare.
Okay. And rare. Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
All right, thank you for your time.
Amy?
Chair Byron, members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, invited to come here today and speak about some of the facts and figures around the situation. And I'll start, Chair Byer, by saying I, like you, am troubled by the situation the Cooks described, and I'll be asking DMV to look into these matters. I'm not personally familiar with them. But what I can tell you is that the DMV business regulations section, which is overseen by a statutorily created body, has authority to sanction dealers who don't follow the law, who misbehave, and those sanctions can range from a warning to suspending their license, their certificate to do business, to civil penalties. In the kind of situation where an individual is not given their title in a timely fashion, and a complaint is filed, DMV will investigate that. In a first offense kind of a situation, and if the title is produced within 90 days, typically a DMV will issue a warning. If it's either not the first offense or it goes beyond 90 days, typically that's a $1,000 civil penalty to the dealer. But these situations take place in two cases. One are those individual situations where one person is not given their title, and the other is what was described, that dealer out of business situation where you have multiple claims to the DMV and or on the bond, and whether that's a consumer, secured interest holder, or others who have some kind of claim, and those can be large, and that bond gets eaten up very quickly. But the reality is that while DMV's role is to require that bond and ensure that it is in place, DMV has no role in the pursuit of the bond by the customer. So what DMV can do is investigate and try to assist people in getting their title where it's appropriate. But that requires an investigation. It requires proof. Not all claims are substantiated. And one other item I will raise in terms of the numbers that have been described. So we found in 2016, we had 644 dealer complaints. Not all of those were substantiated. Of those, there were 139 sanctions issued by DMV, including for civil penalties, but many of those were resolved by securing the title for the customer. And so far in 2017, we've got 181 dealer complaints, and 51 of those have resulted in penalties to date. And that's about it in terms of rough numbers and description of the process. I'd be happy to answer those questions that I can.
Senator Riley.
Thank you. So Mr. Fuller has said something about 30 days. You're talking about 90 days. Can you tell me how that works?
Mm-hmm. Chair Beyer and Senator Riley, I believe it's the statute requires the dealer to produce the title in 30 days. Mr. Fuller described situations. I'm sure there are other situations where that title doesn't show up within 30 days. I think many times a customer may not complain and it just shows up. The 90 days that I described is when we've received a complaint and we're working on the dealer to produce the title when it's been substantiated. If the title shows up within the 90 days and it's a first offense, then DMV will let that dealer off with a warning.
So should the law be 90 days?
Chair Beyer and Senator Riley, I hadn't put any thought into that. I can certainly talk to my folks as to what's reasonable.
If you're saying that, you know, that's when you see it as a problem, I mean, it seems reasonable to me. There's at least something in between. If you can't get a title in 30 days in a normal situation, or even in outside situations, if it sometimes takes longer, then it seems to me that the law should be the 90 days, and the temporary should be 90 days. So,
opinion. Anything else? Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
Sure. Come on up.
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, Senator Riley, I'd like to answer your question. Mr. Fuller explained a situation where things are beyond the dealer's control, where they can't receive this title.
Leave your name again, please.
My name is Young Walgan Kim, attorney here in Salem. So Mr. Fuller described a situation where things are beyond the dealer's control, where they can't get the title within 30 days because of hang up with the finance company. Mm-hmm. We do recognize those things do happen, and the law actually recognizes that. The statute says the dealer has 30 days to deliver the title, but after 25 days, if the dealer realizes that this isn't going to happen within 30 days, they have to give a written notice to the buyer saying it's going to take longer. And as long as they do that, then they have 90 days now to get the title. So that law is already in effect in the dealer code. And I do also want to mention that Mr. Fuller wanted to blow things out of proportion and saying all things are going to be horrible for his dealers. The thing is, my practice is all we do is bring lawsuits against car dealers for violations of Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And we already get attorney fees for bringing those kinds of claims. So if dealers sold a car and the engine falls out, okay, we can bring a claim against the dealer. We don't, 99% of the time, we don't charge our clients for that. We get that those attorney fees from the dealer and the bond. So that those claims we already have and we already get attorney fees for. For example, Ms. Francine Beck had such a claim, a UTPA claim for in addition to the title claim. So we were able to get paid for her UTPA side of it. But we also represented her to deliver the title. Now, we're talking about situations where failure to deliver title is the only violation. And those things happen all the time. The dealers, they do everything right, except they just didn't deliver the title. And we get those phone calls all the time, and we can't help them. We'll take some people on contingency. On pro bono. Mm-hmm. But we can only take so many at a time, and with this bill, we'll be able to represent more people and collect attorney fees from the dealer or the bond. And we're not talking about a lot of money. We're talking about, on the average, about $1,000 per case.
Okay. What? Senator?
The problem is, in definition, it just says a reasonable attorney fees, and that's not defined. So if we put parameters in there, would you be okay with that, saying no more than $1,000?
Well, Senator Girard, I would love to have those kinds of situation in the law, but unfortunately, a lot of the what makes the attorney fees go up, it really isn't because of the plaintiff. It's when the defendant says, well, I'm going to fight you on this. I don't think I broke the law. And so, because what we usually do is when there's a violation, we send a letter, because that's the least amount of work to get the best result for our client the fastest, and says, hey, look, this is the violation, and here are the clear violations, and it's going to be such and such an attorney fees. But when the defendant says, no, we're going to fight you, then we're forced to go to court, and then the attorney fees go up. And so most statutes say, most attorney fee statutes have identical language, reasonable attorney fees, for those very reasons.
But the question is, if it is in dispute and your side is determined to be in error, they have no way to get their attorney fees back. And that's not in this bill. So somehow we have to level the playing field a little bit to make sure. I understand that people see these big, bad automobile dealers, but sometimes, I hate to say it, you'll represent people that really are not in the right. And so I don't know. That's why I want to either limit the attorney fees or balance it out so that if you do lose, then they pay attorney fees.
Well, Senator Girard, to answer your question, we get phone calls all the time from consumers saying they've been injured. We turn most of those away because they're not good claims. If we were to bring those, we would lose, and we would spend all this time litigating these cases, and we wouldn't make any money on it. So practically, that just doesn't happen. Even on the cases that we think are good, I can just tell you from experience, it's like David and Goliath. We are climbing a very, very steep mountain. Well, I wouldn't be doing this. I don't do this for the money. I do it because I believe in what I do.
More?
No, okay.
It's been a while since I've dealt with this issue, but if you go to court, and you ask for attorney's fees, you have to file for attorney's fees. Is that correct? And
that
it's up to the court to decide whether it's reasonable attorney's fees or not.
That is correct, Chair Beyer. We do have to file a petition for attorney fees, and there is a very strict rule about what the factors are in determining what the reasonable fee is. You have to list every single item. You have to have a detailed bill to the court. And the other side gets to pick at my fees and say, this isn't reasonable, cross all these out and say, your rate isn't reasonable. So there is already a system in play to make things fair in those kinds of situations.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you very much. I think we're going to close the public hearing on this one. And we have some people who, we're not going to go to work session on this right now. We have an informational meeting, and the people have come from the Central Oregon, and we'll let them talk about it. So, Patrick?
Oh, so, Mr. Chair, I think we're going to be kicked off by Senator Knope and Representative Bueller are going to
there
be kicked
go.
Off, and then they will introduce the next panel, and we'll just kind of go from there.
Senator, Representative, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm State Senator Tim Knope, representing Senate District 27, which includes Bend, Redmond, Tumalo, and Sun River. I do want to thank you very much for having this hearing today on a very important issue, which we obviously have a project that is of, we think, statewide and regional importance in that expanding the campus, Cascades campus in Bend. And just wanted to say that Representative Bueller and I have worked very hard on this issue when I was in the legislature in a previous life.
You still are.
In the House. Senator, actually, Representative Bueller now represents. But, you know, with Representative Westland and Senator Clarno and Senator Bryant, we helped found and fund the OSU Cascades campus, and it's really important as a regional effort to continue to expand that, because literally there really aren't any other places for higher ed to grow in Oregon than that particular campus. And so, you know, in terms of region and equity, it's important. About 70% of the students that go there are from the region. And in terms of job creation and the ability to for companies to hire a workforce that is educated, it's critically important as well. And so with that, I'd like to introduce Representative Bueller, who is a Rhodes Scholar. I believe went to Johns Hopkins University. And the most important thing is I believe he was a pitcher for the OSU Beaver baseball team back in the day.
Wow, I didn't expect all that.
So,
you know. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Senator. For the record, my name is Representative Newt Bueller. I represent House District 54, and I have to admit a long line of very important representative has held the seat, including Senator Kano. So, but thank you having me today. You know, I appreciate the great work that's been done not only by Senator Knope, but the entire Central Oregon community to really lend support for the university. And there's lots of reasons for it. And certainly Senator Knope talked to that in terms of equity, in terms of access to higher education. And I think the other area to really stress is the incredible entrepreneurial activity that is blossoming in Central Oregon. It is really remarkable if you haven't been to Central Oregon in terms of all the entrepreneurial activity. In fact, it's just not recognized now by us, but also by national rankings who go through and look at these areas of the country that are creating a lot of startup activity. In Bend and Central Oregon specifically has been ranked as one of the number one entrepreneurial regions in the country. And that's something we should all really be paying attention to and try to model and figure out why that's happening, especially in a place that doesn't have access to a four-year university, at least until recently. We haven't had access to a four-year university. And that's gotten a lot of people's attention. And when they really study why that is, why Central Oregon has been so much on the forefront of creating startup activity and entrepreneurship, and it's really due to two reasons. One is the high quality of life. People really want to live there, right? It's an attractive place. It's beautiful. There's lots of things to do. But many times people can't get jobs, so they move there. And they have to bootstrap themselves and figure out a way to pay the bills and start their business and get going. Well, that's created quite a culture in Central Oregon of a bunch of entrepreneurs. And when you look around and see similar areas in the country that have had a incredible amount of startup activity and entrepreneurs, those are two big factors, right? A place where people want to live in an entrepreneurial culture. But there's lots of other factors that kind of build upon that that we don't have right now. And one of the big factors is what they call an innovation engine. And most often, that's something that generates a lot of new ideas. And most commonly, that's a university. So if you combine that existing entrepreneurial spirit and culture that exists in Central Oregon with a real four-year university and that innovation engine, I think you'll see an incredible amount of business development activity in addition to providing access, much-needed access to higher education. So I very much would encourage your support of continued business, continued development of OSU Cascades.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. We have a great group of people that are going to explain a lot of detail to you. Very important, obviously, to our process and the support of this project.
Great. So are you going to introduce them or facilitate?
No. We are going to
get they know who's coming up next.
They know who's coming up next. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank
you. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Beyer and members of the committee, I'm Becky Johnson. I'm Vice President for OSU Cascades, and thank you for letting us have time with your committee today. We're seeking bonds in the legislative session to expand OSU Cascades. We are going to be at capacity in 2021, and so we need to have a new building in place by that time. And our project is simply about capacity. We're not asking for sports facilities. We're not asking for dorms. It's simply academic buildings for students and faculty. We're raising $10 million in philanthropy, and the students are putting in $5 million in student fees as matches to this project. And I've been really fortunate to have so many members of Central Oregon, as the senator and representative have said, who are supportive of OSU Cascades. And we've been in Salem earlier in the session to talk about the access to higher education. But today we want to talk about the economic development impacts of having this university in Central Oregon. And I arrived there in 2009, which, as you know, is not a great time for the economy, and didn't know people in the business and economic development sector at that time. But I took it upon myself to get to know those people and to talk about their challenges and opportunities. And the result has been we have developed new degrees such as energy systems engineering and computer science, hospitality management, in collaboration with the businesses there to serve their workforce needs. And so I'm so fortunate to have these supporters now, including local chambers of commerce and members of the business community. And I'm particularly grateful that they have taken the time to drive all the way over from Central Oregon today to spend some time with your committee. So thank you very much.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm Orrin Teeter. I reside in Bend, Oregon. I'm a fourth-generation Oregonian. I moved to Bend in 1971 and have been involved in the community in the state of Oregon ever since. I served as president of the Bend Chamber of Commerce, founding member of Economic Development for Central Oregon, city councilor, mayor for the city of Bend, and for the past 17 years, I've served on the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors. And I would add, the only member that's not from the Willamette Valley. Finally, it's been my honor to serve as chair of the OSU Cascades Advisory Board for the past several years. Over this period of time, Central Oregon has seemed to experience the brunt of each recession, catching pneumonia when the rest of the state caught a cold. We were hammered in the Great Recession with unemployment at 17.2% in March of 2009. Home prices fell 50%, new construction ground to a halt. Through each of these recessions over the past 40 years, residents have coined the phrase, poverty with a view. But Bend Metro has come back with top job growth in the nation at 6.6%, with its five-year annual rate at 3.8, ranked among the highest in the country. Bend companies enjoy business costs that are 22% below the national average, and its high share of educated millennials ranks in the top 10% of smaller metro areas. OSU Cascades has been a critical factor in supplying the educated workforce. Bend ranks number one in the Forbes release Best Small Places in the U.S. to Do Business.
The Milken Institute also ranked Ben Redmond area as number one best performing cities in 2016. Our remarkable status is frequently a point of discussion with members of the Governor's Council, asking why we do far better than the balance of the state. Again, OSU has been an important factor in our remarkable turnaround, but OSU Cascades will hit capacity in 2020. And without further expansion, the supply of necessary workforce, further economic growth may be jeopardized. Even more importantly for Central Oregon, the prosperity of Bend in recent years is just beginning to reach the remainder of the region. There will be significant needs and challenges ahead. OSU Cascades serves all Central Oregon, with many students coming from rural areas and landing internships and jobs across the region. Without the expansion of OSU Cascades, students and businesses in these areas will be more vulnerable and will be disproportionately impacted. New business, new entrepreneurs demand a solid four-year university to support their companies and their employees. Oregon State Cascades develops degree programs to meet the needs of area businesses for educated and motivated employees. OSU Cascades will continue to grow, now has the acreage to prosper, but needs the support of the legislature to move to the next phase by 2021. We ask you to support the OSU Cascades funding of $69.5 million request for capital expansion. Without the additional funding in these buildings, the campus will not be able to meet the needs of our rapidly growing area, one that is finally gaining economic stability, vibrancy, missing elements since the demise of the timber industry. Thank you.
Chairman Beyer, rest of the senators and committee, thank you very much for the time to present today. My name is S.J. Camerata. I live in Bend. I've been there for a little over 20 years. I'm in the technology business. I've been very fortunate. I've been involved in a number of companies. I've served a number of boards. One of the companies I work for is a company called Esri. We're the largest mapping, digital mapping, analytics, and science technology company for geographic analysis in the world. We've got millions of users around the world and literally thousands of business partners, many of which are in Oregon, in the valley on this side of the mountains, that is, but also in the Bend area. We do try to foster and grow new businesses and try to invest in companies and help them grow. And a business climate like we have in Bend is important for that, as well as a higher education institution and university. The Bend area, as you've heard, over the last couple of years, has evolved into a vibrant region for innovation, economic, and business growth, especially in the technology, but in other sectors and clusters, as we refer to them. Our city council recently passed a resolution which now is named Bend the Innovation City. And while this is kind of a statement, it's also very powerful, and it's actually providing us an opportunity to bring in European investments and some other work that we're working on with some other organizations overseas. Existing innovative companies are growing and there are also many startup companies in the technology sectors and in the Central Oregon area. And these include many disciplines, including software, hardware, robotics, unmanned aerial vehicles or drones, if you might have heard, biosciences in the health sector, and many other sectors. Our local Chamber of Commerce estimated that in January alone of this year, over 300 new companies were started. So there's a vibrant economic growth that is starting to happen, or that continues to happen since the Great Recession. Part of this is due to a thriving base of existing companies and professionals that serve as a talent pool for both management and staff. Part of the growth is influenced by better access to capital. But this is not enough if we want to continue to retain and add more continual smart businesses. A crucial challenge that we face is talent creation and retention. OSU Cascades is critical for this. Without a proper engine to educate skilled professionals, Bend and Central Oregon are at a disadvantage when compared to other communities. Every leading community in the United States that is associated with entrepreneurial growth, and some examples are Boulder, Colorado, Silicon Valley, Austin, Texas, they have one very important characteristic that is similar among all of them, and that is that they have a four-year university or more that drives and supports these type of innovation and growth. The universities provide quality pools of interns to support the growing needs of businesses and startups. They create new innovative leaders and also founders of startups, and they help foster innovation and research and development. It also is important for building networking capacity for a world of partner institutions and other universities, both throughout the United States and around the world. I know I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for my education at university, both an undergraduate and graduate school. During my university years, I worked hard. I got research grants, and as soon as I graduated from graduate school, I started my first, co-founded my first company and was successful with that. Where I'm asking you to please consider this extra funding we're asking for to give many opportunities to other thousands of students that would be coming to Central Oregon and OSU Cascades, as we believe it would be part of something to be tremendous for the state of Oregon, not just the region. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Question?
You've got a question?
Oh, sorry.
Oops. Senator?
There you go.
What's your relationship with Central Oregon Community College? And you have a relationship. I happen to know that the campus, the main campus in Corvallis, has a very close working relationship with Lynn Benton Community College. I wondered if you had a similar relationship in terms of transferability and those kinds of things, and students having an opportunity to take classes at both Bend campuses at the same time, the kinds of things that they're doing in Corvallis.
Senator Beyer, Senator Monroe, we probably have an even closer relationship because we were actually living on their campus for the last 15 years or so. Now we're about 2 miles away from their campus. But at this time, if you apply as a student to OSU Cascades and get accepted, you are automatically also enrolled or accepted at COCC. And so you're dually enrolled at both institutions, which makes it very easy to take two of your classes at COCC while you're taking two of your classes at OSU Cascades. We've paid for a dedicated bus route to go between these two campuses, so students that need that kind of transportation can do that easily. We advise students who are dually enrolled for what courses they're going to need as juniors and seniors to make sure that they're not wasting credits in their freshman sophomore year. So if you start at COCC not knowing that you want to come on to OSU Cascades, you still might take classes that will turn out not to be useful for your major. But if you know that you're going to do that, we work very closely to make sure there are no extra credits.
Well, I applaud that. And I have been a strong supporter of the OSU Cascades. I am a strong supporter of providing higher education opportunities to young people that graduate from our high schools east of the mountains, because I happen to know that our high school students that graduate east of the mountains are less than half as likely to end up going to college anywhere. And so having the opportunities in Central Oregon and also in LeGrand and so on, I think very, very important. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to start off this round. One of Becky's fan clubs here. Chair Beyer and members of the committee, my name is Rita Hansen. I'm the CEO of Onboard Dynamics. We are actually OSU Cascades' first company that was created and launched from technology and research originating from an idea that was in a professor's head, an innovative professor named Dr. Chris Hagen, who was actually hired by Becky just under 5 years ago. So as an energy startup, we represent the future and potential of Central Oregon and Oregon. We've raised close to $7 million that we've brought into the state and have built a company that now has 9 full-time employees and contractors who are professionals, engineers, and highly skilled technicians based in our region. I'm going to tell a story about our most recent 2 hires, which actually fall into Senator Monroe's comments. So our most recent 2 hires were engineers graduating from OSU Cascades Energy Systems Engineering Program. The youngest, 26-year-old Sean Maia, was born and raised in Tumalo, Oregon, graduated from Redmond High School. After working as an auto mechanic in his family's business for 9 years, he elected to get his energy systems engineering degree, given that it was a program that sounded interesting and was offered at the local campus. We hired Sean the day after he graduated 2 years ago. Over the past, in these past 2 years, he's become one of our most important contributors. He was recently promoted into an engineering manager position, and he was able to purchase his first house. Our other engineer, Raymond Kuhn, that we hired last year, is a U.S. Navy veteran who was enlisted for 8 years on a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier. And when he left the Navy, he was searching for an engineering program that could enhance the real-world experiences and training he had already incurred as a Navy officer. He was an electrician. He was looking for something that would offer relevancy to problems that need to be addressed today, especially in the energy sector. He was encouraged to check into the Energy Systems Engineering Program at OSU Cascades, and he moved his family from Seattle with his two boys and his wife, who is a cancer therapist. And even though he technically didn't have a position open when he graduated last June, he had credentials, he had experience, and he had this relevant degree that we all agreed we could not pass this up. We have not looked back. These two young men are real success stories for Central Oregon. This type of technical talent that's coming from OSU Cascades really fills a critical need for companies like mine that not only start in Bend, but want to stay and grow in Bend. This unique, one-of-its-kind energy systems engineering program is very broad in nature. It combines energy, engineering discipline, and business management that produces highly technical professionals that can tackle many different aspects of energy across the state. Energy conversion, energy distribution, energy consumption, and energy storage. Currently, there's 126 students in this program today. They're finding jobs because they are in high demand. I really appreciate your support and listening to this story, because this is why we need OSU Cascades in our backyard.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Chris Van Dyke. I am a resident of Bend. I moved to Oregon in the 70s and actually first practiced law here in Salem. For the last 30 years, I have been working with the outdoor industry. I was a general manager of Nike's outdoor division. I worked as a vice president of marketing and product development at Patagonia, you're probably familiar with. I started a small company in Portland, and I now do consulting work for outdoor companies, largely in Oregon. You're probably familiar with the recent data that was provided by the Outdoor Industry Association of America. They actually quantified the size of the recreation economy in every state. And Oregon's numbers were impressive. There's about $12 billion in revenue per year generated in Oregon, about 150,000 jobs, and almost $1 billion in taxes and fees. It's a sizable industry. Just in Bend alone, we have 100 new outdoor companies, and that's since the recession in 2008. One of them you're probably familiar with, Hydro Flask, which is exceeding now $100 million in sales. Recently, I was retained by OSU Cascades to help craft a four-year degree program in outdoor product creation and management. My research, and more importantly, the professor who eventually run this program, were subsidized by a generous grant from Hydro Flask. They recognized the need that for employees and talent, if they were going to grow their business, they needed to have people who were trained at a college level, in a degree program, to assume positions. They're having problems with talent acquisition. As wonderful as Bend is, they needed people who actually had some skills to help grow their business. When I was involved in doing the research for this, I interviewed about 75 CEOs around the United States. I talked to people at Nike, Adidas, Columbia, Keen, companies in Oregon. I talked to Patagonia. I traveled the West to Utah and the trade show. And during those interviews, to a person, there was genuine enthusiasm about creating what would be the first degree program to train leaders in the outdoor industry in product creation. They recognized this is a huge opportunity. They were interested in participating in internships and creating endowments. Yvonne Chouinard volunteered to come and teach a course on business ethics at OSU. So even the most curmudgeon leaders in the outdoor industry were really excited and interested in this.
When I first started at Nike, they were the one footwear and apparel company in the outdoor industry in Oregon. Because of them and because of the center they created, Oregon is now the center of outdoor footwear and apparel. I do not think it at all unreasonable to believe that Oregon could similarly become a center for outdoor product creation. Forbes magazine recently recognized Bend as one of those potential cities that could become the leader in the industry because of what's going on there. I think the growth of the university, the support of this program and others provides huge opportunities for not just Central Oregon, but for the entire state of Oregon to invite and grow an industry segment that has huge potential for the state. So thank you for your support.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Byron, committee members, for having us here today. I am Mike O'Haron. I'm the Vice President, General Manager of Crestview Cable Communications. We are a cable television, internet, and telephone company that has served Central Oregon for over 50 years, a family-owned business. We cover all those services. I, like Orrin Teeter before me, am a past president of the Bend Area Chamber of Commerce, and I've lived in the Bend area off and on since 1989. And so, like some of you and some of us, we've experienced the ups and downs of the volatile economy that seems to hit first and recover last in Central Oregon. Over the past 25 years, we've moved from a timber and agricultural-based economy to one driven by data centers, tourism, outdoor recreation, and others that require a completely different kind of job force than those industries did. This has been a painful transition for some of our citizens. In today's go-go economy, we forget about some of those people that were sort of left behind or not prepared for the economy, for the recession, the Great Recession, and for the economy that followed. And some of our communities, particularly some of the smaller ones that we serve, are still recovering from that Great Recession. Now more than ever, we need stable funding for OSU Cascades. We need capital for a building expansion. We literally are going to run out of seats, not something most universities here in the state of Oregon face. We need a four-year university that can help real people make that transition from one economy to another, feed a sizzling economy that we're in now, and perhaps most importantly for some of us that have been there a long time, help us avoid the Great Recession of the mid-2000s. Many people think that OSU Cascades is Bend-centric, but it has wide support across Central Oregon. Our small company currently has one employee who graduated from Crook County High School in Prineville and another who graduated from Lapine High School, who both, after attending COCC, are now enrolled at OSU Cascades and expect to graduate next year with their bachelor's degree. On the other hand, to reinforce what Senator Monroe said, I have a great nephew in the Portland area who is an outdoor fanatic who will graduate next year in the outdoor industry with a bachelor's degree and be able to work and already has a job in the outdoor industry. So you see it goes both ways. And he could not have got that degree at any other university in our state. So he goes from Portland to Central Oregon, gets his degree at OSU Cascades, and already has a job a year ahead of his graduation. So it is an important part of our community, of our region, OSU Cascades. And ironically, I started working on this 20 years ago and was part of the original committee that worked with others to bring a four-year university to Central Oregon. And although I'm a duck, it turned out to be OSU Cascades, and I couldn't be happier. So thank you for your support, and if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Byer, committee members, my name is Tom Rowley. I'm the Bend Area Director with EDCO Economic Development for Central Oregon. We are the state's largest private nonprofit economic development organization, and very pleased to be here today in support of OSU Cascades budget request and urge you to fully support it.
Serving Deschutes, Jefferson, and Crook counties for the past 36 years, EDCO works with traded sector companies to help them move, start, and grow in Central Oregon. And in all three of those aspects, OSU Cascades plays is an asset of immeasurable value. Move. Time after time, when I'm talking to companies from around the country that are interested in possibly relocating to Oregon, they say that OSU Cascades is a major draw, a huge asset, and is a real part of their consideration. Not only do they see it as a source of workforce, they also see it as an intellectual and cultural hub, and they want to get involved in it. Start for entrepreneurs, such as my friend and colleague Rita Hansen was talking about onboard dynamics. The research capacity of OSU Cascades is huge. Its faculty, its students, its facilities is at the heart of these firms' efforts and successes. Grow. Most of my work involves working with the existing traded sector companies in the region. And for those, the presence of OSU Cascades, the generation of trained workforce, the ability to train their existing workers, and more add immeasurably to their ability to succeed and create jobs and tax base in Central Oregon. EDCO also facilitates the industry sector clusters that were mentioned earlier. Again, the success of these clusters depend greatly upon the university. As Chris Van Dyke was saying, the outdoor gear and apparel sector in Central Oregon, 100-ish companies with 640 employees, is working with OSU to create that undergraduate degree track, and is that, again, represents a huge asset when we're talking to companies from around the country that are interested in coming to Central Oregon and being a part of that emerging hub, that national hub of the outdoor sector. Bioscience and technology, Bend Research, Grace Biolabs, and so many other companies that have spun off out of that work closely with OSU Cascades, its faculty, and its Innovation Center for Entrepreneurship. In closing, OSU Cascades is a key building block in Central Oregon's and the state's economy, and its expansion is the next step in creating an innovation hub and economic engine benefiting the entire state, and we urge your full support. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, committee members. My name is Melanie Widmer. I'm the president of Madras Sanitary Service, the former mayor of Madras, and I'm also a student at OSU Cascades, the only student in the bunch today. So rural areas of Central Oregon, such as Jefferson County, where I'm from, face a lot of economic hurdles. We have higher poverty rates and lower graduation rates. Only about 16% of adults in Jefferson County have a four-year degree. We're scrappy, though, and we work hard to bring jobs to our community, but we need the tools to do it. And one of the biggest keys to improving the economy of Jefferson County is by having a university within commuting distance. Our largest employer in Jefferson County by far is a wood products manufacturer. That industry obviously is volatile, and when layoffs come, as they inevitably do, we need opportunities for our people to go back to school and get equipped for a new career, and OSU Cascades is a perfect tool for that. And we in rural Central Oregon need opportunities for our young people. Most of our kids are not from families of college graduates, and they don't have a lot of financial resources. They're much more likely to attend a university that they don't have to move away from their entire support system. As a young person, I myself was unable to move away from Central Oregon because of family and my family business commitments. I was able to commute to community college in Bend, even though it's 50 miles away. But beyond that, I couldn't continue on because there was no university in Central Oregon. I had to wait a long time. I won't tell you exactly how long, but a long time. But finally, OSU Cascades came to Central Oregon, and I went back to school. I put a lot of miles on my car, but I'm now almost finished with my Bachelor's of Science in Business Administration. And my experience at OSU Cascades has been overwhelmingly positive. And I've gained all kinds of skills and knowledge that I've been able to apply directly to my business. The degree program that I'm taking is a great entryway into all kinds of Central Oregon companies and also provides a solid foundation for someone wanting to start their own business. The program and OSU Cascades overall is serving the students and businesses of Central Oregon very well. The expansion of the campus will allow this good work to continue. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
She's done a lot for a young lady that can't be over 29.
Thank you very much.
That was very good. Are there anyone else? That's it? Well, thank you all for driving over and sharing with us. You're obviously mostly you're interested in what's going to happen down in Ways and Means, but I really appreciate it. I've said many times that I think the Central Oregon area is going to become the Oregon's next Washington County. I think it's growing, and I guess that's good and bad. I've heard it both ways. Speaking with Chamber of Commerce, I think it was yesterday, from Bandaria about that, and it's going to happen, and you will need that institution, so I appreciate it. You know, one of the things that I think most Oregonians don't know is the level of technology firms that you have in the Bend area. And it's amazing. So, anyway, Senator Riley.
Just wanted to say that Washington County is happy to share. So, I wish them a lot of luck getting this. So, Ways and Means is who you got to talk to.
I was going
to
say, at least we won't have to spend the same money expanding 217, but we sort of have the same problem over there with 97, so on the transportation side. So thank you very much. You. I appreciate it.
Chairman?
One more time.
Just one last. You might wonder why you're talking to this committee instead of Ways and Means, but three members of this committee are prominent on Ways and Means, including Senator Girard, who's not here right now, who is the chair of the Capital Construction Subcommittee, and will be making direct decisions on what projects get bonding money and so on. And I'm on the full Ways and Means Committee as well, Senator Thompson. So we'll be dealing with these issues directly. Thank you all for coming over.
Rod's also a beaver, but other than that. All righty. So we're going to go back up to do that one.
Oh, we have a hearing. We have one person here for this.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
We have two more hearings.
So we're going to, no, we don't. The other one we're going to carry. So we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2132. Patrick?
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2132 expands the purpose for which improvements can be made under local government financing programs to include energy storage, smart electric vehicle charging stations, and water efficiency. This measure has minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact. There's no amendments, Mr. Chair, and this has a House vote of 53-2, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, and good afternoon.
Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Sam Barrasso, and I work for Multnomah County's Office of Sustainability. I'm responsible, and I'm going to keep it short here, hopefully, and let you all ask questions, but I'm responsible for the development of Oregon's first commercial property assessed clean energy program under the program which House Bill 2132 seeks to amend. The legislature first approved the program in 2009, amended it in 2014. It allows private commercial building owners to get access to private financing for energy efficiency and renewable energy upgrades. It does so through a mechanism that's really similar to local improvement districts, which have been around for nearly a century. They're used to finance sewer improvements, sidewalks, streetlights. And so our bill here today seeks to expand the eligible measures under this program by including water efficiency, energy storage, and EV charging stations. Essentially, Multnomah County has been the first jurisdiction that's been authorized and that's locally authorized the program and has been engaging in connecting with building owners to use this program. And as we've done that, what we've seen is that we have a big piece of the program missing, and that's really been water efficiency. It's just when we have a conversation with building owners, it isn't often, and we want to be able to bring a holistic perspective to say, all right, when we're talking about upgrading lights, solar panels, windows, HVAC systems, let's also talk about water systems. And so as we mentioned, this program doesn't use any general fund, and it's based on a property owner voluntarily seeking to use it. So it's going to allow us to bring a more holistic building resiliency program to our commercial building owners in the state, and hopefully we'll see other jurisdictions adopting this program soon. So with that, I urge your vote on House Bill 2132, your support vote, and I'm here to answer any questions you may have.
Questions? Any questions? I guess not. Let's see. That's it. That's all I had signed up. Does anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 2132? Guess not. So we'll close that. Are we ready to move it? We'll open the work session on House Bill 2132.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 2132 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thompson has moved House Bill 2132 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion on that motion? Is there opposition to that motion? There is none. Is there a volunteer carrier? Senator Thompson. So Senator Thompson will carry, and we'll move on. 10-2. We got to go back up to the.
Do we want to do the green? Just make this official and carry this bill over to Wednesday.
Okay.
The 31st.
Do I have to open the hearing now?
No, no. You just have to announce it.
Well, I should ask first. Is anybody here that wanted to testify on House Bill 3268? Seeing none. Okay, for the record here, we will carry that bill over till our next meeting, which is the 31st. And then, let's see, do we want to do greenlets?
Absolutely, sure.
So we'll open a work session on House Bill 2111A.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 2111A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Thompson's moved House Bill 2111A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
I thought there was supposed to be an amendment for that one.
Is there an amendment?
I don't think we have. You think maybe 2511. This is 2111.
Oh, okay.
We're covered, Mr. Chairman.
Huh?
We're clear.
We're good?
No amendment for this one.
All right. Back again. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? House Bill 2111A moves to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
I'm going to change. I'm going to be a no.
Huh?
I want to be a no.
And we will record Senator Girard as a no on that. Would you like to carry it?
Carrier, sure. I'd be happy to.
Monroe wants to carry. So we're closed on that. Then we're going to go just check out here. Then we want to go to House Bill 2510. We'll open a work session on that.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2510A to with, oh, geez. How come so many?
Well, there's only one.
Oh, well, it's up to dash 7. Mr. Chair.
Took him a while to get it right.
I guess. I move the dash 7 to yes. House Bill 2510.
Senator Thompson moves the dash A7 amendments to House Bill 2510. Discussion on the motion. Any opposition to the motion? The amendments adopted?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2510 with a dash 7 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Thompson's moved House Bill 2510A as amended by the dash 7 amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, House Bill 2510 moves as amended by the dash 7 moves to the Senate floor with unanimous support. Is there anybody want to volunteer carry?
I'm not carrying that.
Oh, got it. I'll take it.
Oh, you can have it. Okay.
We're closed on that one. We'll open on 2511A.
Are we moving?
It's a work session.
Four and?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Four
maybe,
and five.
Maybe I could clarify the amendments, Mr. Chair. So there are two separate amendments that do not conflict, but both need to be adopted, Mr. Chair. The dash A4 specified charging stations must be installed and removed. It adds the end removed by a licensed electrician, and the dash A5 yep. is decreases the requirement amount of insurance from $1 million to $100,000, Mr. Chair.
So, can I do that? Both of them at a time, or
one at a time?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash A4 amendment to House Bill 2511.
Senator Thompson's moved the dash. Be careful here. Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2511A. Did you want to talk on this?
No.
Okay. And is there any discussion on that? Is there any opposition to that? There is none. It's adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash A5 amendment also to House Bill 2511.
Senator Thompson's moved the dash A5 amendment to House Bill 2511A. Discussion on the motion? Seeing none, is there any opposition? It's adopted. To the floor.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 2511 with the dash 4 and the Dash 5 and any other ones they come up with to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Well, once it's done, there aren't any others. Oh,
okay. Yeah.
House Bill 2511A, as amended by the Dash A4 and Dash A5 amendments, is moved to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the motion?
Too many
is there any opposition to the motion? You didn't object to the other one, but you won't object to this one?
Well, there's too many.
Huh?
Yes.
You do? Okay.
Thank you. There's too many amendments.
The commercial people were okay with it.
Huh?
The first, never mind.
All righty. Let's be clear here. Who wants to object? You're going to make it a partisan vote?
Yes.
Well, I don't care how he votes. I'm voting. No.
Okay.
We're not colluding on this.
Does anybody else want to get in the game? All right. House Bill 2511A, as amended by the Dash A4 and Dash A5 amendments, moves to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Senators Girard and Thompson object. Or opposed.
Did you want to carry?
They also object. I guess I'll carry the darn thing. We'll do that. Okay.
10 and 11 kind of go together.
They do. I don't understand the objection, but that's okay. And we have one left, House Bill 2737A. We'll open work session on that. We have an amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash A4 to House Bill 2737.
Senator Thompson has moved the Dash A4 amendment to House Bill 2737A. And just to be clear, we heard this one last week. Mm-hmm. What the amendment does is, rather than prescribing the standards for tiny homes in law, it refers it to DCBS to come back to amend the code, which would be effective on January 1st of next year. The same, I think it ends up in exactly the same place. I will note that the chairman requesting the amendment moved it from 400 to 600 feet maximum size.
Oh, okay.
Make it a little more elbow room.
I like that better.
Huh?
I like that better.
I like that better. So, any discussion on the motion?
That's a lot of liberty by the chair.
It's my amendment. Is there any opposition to the?
Where's the opposition? I don't see any.
Well, I'm not worried about him. How about you guys? I don't see any. There's no opposition.
Good bill. Even
so
better.
The amendment's adopted. Move the bill.
You want to carry it?
Oh, move the bill.
No, you're gonna have to move the bill first.
Adopted the
amendment. Mr. Chair, I
we
move
adopted
House
the
bill
amendment.
2737 with the chairman's with the Dash A4. To the floor.
Senator Thompson's move. House Bill 2737A, as amended by the A4.
That's what I said.
Amendments. That's what you said. I'm repeating it here.
Oh, okay.
To the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
I want to ask staff. So this is, we're going to put these in by rule. It's going to be by rule, not by statute, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Just want to clarify.
Shall adopt construction standards.
To clarify, it directs the department to amend the building code to provide for these.
That's right.
So that is the reason we're doing it, is to be consistent with how the legislature adopts the building code.
That's right.
Yes.
So do we have a motion on the floor? We do. We have a motion on the floor. Is there further discussion? Is there any opposition?
If I vote for it, I still don't have to carry it, right?
We'll decide that afterwards.
No, can I vote no?
No, it's yes. House Bill 2737A, as amended by the Dash A4, moves to the Senate floor with a do pass, and the chair will carry. We're closed on that, and do we have another one to move? You know, I think we're going to move House Bill 2975A, and we're going to carry that over to the 31st.
Okay.
And that's it. We did this, right? We did do it. I announced that. We carried that over.
We carried that over, Mr. Chair.
We're done. We are adjourned.
Help somebody that.